Welcome to History Class After Hours. I'm Joseph Barron. Joining me is Eli.
Good morning.
We're back from break.
Yes, we are.
Ready for
5 weeks of rest and relaxation.
Yes.
Let's do this.
Ready for more exciting learning opportunities and experiences.
Always.
Today we're talking about Warren G. Harding, who most historians often call one of the most corrupt politicians in American history. That's saying a lot. So he was born on November 2nd, 1865, in what is now Blooming Grove, Ohio. He was born on a farm and is one of the oldest of eight children. He was a mediocre student, and he would have several jobs before he would buy a struggling weekly newspaper. While running that newspaper, he would meet his wife, Florence Kling DeWolf.
It's a name.
That is quite the name. And under her guidance, she would help turn the Marion Star into a successful daily paper. I guess she was like really good with money, and she was also really stingy with money. And it was said that like every day after the newspaper office closed, she would take like a bag of pennies and bring it to the bank to deposit.
Well, I think I know why these two aren't going to get along very well.
She was also a clever politician and bragged about getting Warren elected president. She would say, Warren does well when he listens to me and badly when he does not. So she's kind of like the puppet master controlling the puppet that's going to be Warren G. Harding. With the success of the paper, Harding began to get invited to lead corporate boards and fraternal organizations. He was said to have little intellect or imagination, but was considered to be a rather handsome man.
Not a smart man.
But he's handsome. He looks the part.
Why not be president?
Yes. So even though he lacked skills, he often looked like a natural-born leader, and that would get him far in life. He would find himself to begin to associate with major powers in the state of Ohio and then get involved with what was called the Ohio Gang, which was like a core group of politicians within Ohio. And eventually, Harding would be drawn to the Republican Party and get involved in politics. He'd be elected a state senator from 1899 to 1902, then the lieutenant governor from 1903 to 1904. Lieutenant governor is like the vice governor.
It's like the second in command.
Yes.
I gotcha.
He would run for governor in 1910, but be defeated. He would often align himself with the conservative wing of the Republican Party and would support legislation that supported big business. In 1912, he'd gain national visibility after being chosen to nominate William Howard Taft at the Republican convention. His fame would help him get elected as a U.S. Senator in 1915. In 1920, the Republican convention was in a deadlock over who to nominate to be the Republican presidential candidate. So primaries worked differently back then. I did not know this. There wasn't like actual primaries. So they literally just had a convention, and from my understanding, only 20 states picked the Republican nominee for the presidential campaign.
Interesting.
And literally they would send delegates, and the delegates would have these open forums and discuss, and then they would continually vote to see who would get the nomination. At the Blackstone Hotel in Chicago, Harding is going to be picked as a compromise candidate. So basically the delegates, they have two guys that are fighting for the nomination, and they can't agree on which of the two to pick, so they just compromise on Harding.
Wait a minute. That's he's like the third in line candidate.
Yes. Based off of what I know about Harding, I feel like they feel like they can control him.
I mean, I feel like maybe he wants everyone to think they control him.
And I think, no. He's got other desires, as we'll soon see. Calvin Coolidge would be chosen as his running mate. He would not include a speaking tour for his campaign, but rather what was called a front porch campaign, where all his speeches were given from the front porch of his house in Marion, Ohio. He would just invite people to come and hear them.
This sounds like a terrible campaign.
Well, it's not a terrible campaign when your nominee is incompetent, and this is the best way to control him.
Yes, but you got to get people to come to Marion, Ohio.
It was good for business.
I've never been to Marion, Ohio. I have no idea where this place is.
It's in Ohio.
Early 1900s,
probably a small, But he would invite people in like newspapers and stuff. And then basically all throughout, just using the press is how he got his word out. He also was helped that by after 8 years of the Woodrow Wilson administration, Americans had grown tired of the Democrats' policies. Harding would call for a return to normalcy, which resonated with the American people, and he would win 60% of the popular vote, which is still one of the largest landslide victories in American political history.
Return to normalcy.
Yes. Basically, let's forget about everything that just happened with World War One, and let's get back to how we were before World War One. That was his whole campaign.
Why not?
Yes. So in a speech to Congress early in his term, he would outline the direction the country should take. He said, "I have said to the people, we meant to have less government in business as well as more business in government. It is well to have it understood that business has a right to pursue its normal, legitimate, and righteous way unimpeded, and it ought to have no call to meet government competition where all risk is borne by the public. There is no challenge to honest and lawful business success, but government approval of fortunate, untrammeled business does not mean toleration of restraint of trade or of maintained prices by unnatural methods. It is well to have legitimate business understand that a just government, mindful of the interests of all the people, has a right to expect the cooperation of legitimate business in stamping out the practices which add to unrest and inspire restrictive legislation. Anxious as we are to restore the onward flow of business, it is fair to combine assurance and warning in one utterance." He uses the word business a lot.
Yeah. I know where he stands on that whole big business thing.
He's a big fan of big business.
Yeah. He's right in there with what's his name? The guy before Roosevelt.
Yeah.
I can't think of his name right now.
Teddy?
No, yeah, the guy before Teddy Roosevelt.
Oh.
He was also big business. McKinley.
There you go.
He was huge business.
What happened to McKinley?
It's not good.
Yeah, you got assassinated.
Yeah.
Didn't someone throw a grenade at him or something? A bomb. It was a bomb. It was an explosive of some sort.
I don't actually know how he was assassinated. I've never looked into it.
So when appointing cabinet members, Harding would pick a mix of qualified leaders and corrupt politicians, primarily from the state of Ohio. He's basically picking his friends and relatives to fill out his cabinet.
Sounds like Andrew Jackson.
The corrupt politicians were looking for every opportunity to gain more wealth. Harding was notoriously poor judge of character. He often expected that people he appointed repay him with that appointment with their integrity. However, most of them lacked that, so that would cause issues.
Yeah, if you're looking for integrity from, you know, people who are corrupt, there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not going to have that. I mean...
Yes. But he was unable to see that, so it's going to cause issues.
Not a smart man.
No. So during his presidency, he had several accomplishments. The Thompson-Urrutia Treaty was ratified, which would pay Colombia for the loss of Panama. If you don't know, Panama used to be part of Colombia, and then we armed a bunch of Panamanian rebels to break away from Colombia so we could build the
Panama Canal.
So yay, we finally repaid Colombia for that.
Well, I mean, that's... Okay, yeah.
He signed the Budget and Accounting Act, which created the modern-day process for creating a federal budget.
Okay, he
officially ended the war with Germany without the U.S. joining the League of Nations. However, German reparations would continue to be an issue. Basically, the argument was, do we make them pay reparations or not? Big win for him, Washington Naval Conference. That would prevent a naval arms race, basically saying that the powers that be had to put limitations on how big their ships could be in their navy and how many ships you could build.
Yes.
There was a ratio.
We got a lot of ships.
Yes, but they were smaller.
They were smaller. Yes. We could have like two really, really big ones, or three. Or maybe it was five. I don't know. But like... We limited ourselves, and I think Japan was the second country that had a high limitation.
England.
England?
Japan's going to be mad because they weren't put on the same playing field as England
and
the U.S.
Yes. Well,
I think we talked about that in our Pearl Harbor episode. Shepherd Towner Maternity and Infancy Act was passed, with the federal government would provide more aid for prenatal care for women. Signed the Capper-Volstead Act, which allowed struggling farmers to sell their crops as a cooperative without fear of antitrust laws. Created the first federal narcotics control board.
Okay.
looked over many business disputes between unions and owners, often being the mediator. But however, he would side with big business a lot.
Well, yeah, I mean.
He would also sign acts that would create the precursors to the FAA and the FCC. FAA controls.
I should know this.
You should. You live in Atlanta.
You're right.
I do. Airspace.
Ah, right.
And aviation. FCC controls.
No. Those aren't a thing yet.
Radio and TV.
Gotcha.
It's radio at this point, not TV.
Yeah.
However, he would also put quotas on immigration and introduce protective tariffs that would ruin the economy.
Okay, that's not so good.
Yes.
Everything else is like, okay, yeah, that's great. I mean, pretty good. And then you get to there and it's...
Yes.
It's not good at all, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Once again, I don't know how much of this stuff he is actually doing and how much he is just being a puppet.
You know, just signing for it?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
All right. So there's going to be three major political scandals that will hit his presidency. But what happens is he is very well protected as being president, and a lot of this information won't come out until after he dies. Oh. So, like, when he dies, he is going to be, like, the American public is, like, in deep mourning because the American public loved him because they didn't realize what was going on because that information hadn't been...
Yeah, that's going to be a rough...
Come out yet, yeah.
That's a rough thing.
So, word began to reach the president that some of his friends were using their official positions for their own enrichment. Alarmed, he complained,
what?
I have no trouble with my enemies. I can take my enemies in a fight, but my friends, they're the ones that keep me walking the floors at night. He actually used some choice words to describe his friends, but I can't say that. So he was basically... like depressed and stressed out. And so he journeys westward in the summer of 1923, taking with him the Secretary of Commerce, who was Herbert Hoover. And he said, if you knew of a great scandal in our administration, he would ask Hoover, would you, for the good of the country and the party, expose it publicly, or would you bury it? Hoover urged publishing it, but Harding feared the political repercussions, so he is going to look to bury these scandals. One of the most known political scandals is the Teapot Dome scandal. Basically, the scandal would involve an oil reserve in Wyoming that was set aside for use by the U.S. Navy in case of a national emergency. Harding would, though, sign an executive order transferring the reserve to the Department of the Interior. The Secretary of the Interior, Albert Fall, would then secretly grant Harry Sinclair of the Mammoth Oil Company the exclusive rights to the reserve. When these leases and contracts came under investigation by committees of the U.S. Senate, it was disclosed that shortly after the signing of the Teapot Dome lease, Fall and members of his family had received from an unknown source more than $200,000 in Liberty bonds under circumstances indicating that the bonds came from the company organized by Sinclair and others receiving benefits from the lease. So pretty much you have Fall. He gave the contract to Sinclair. And Sinclair bribed him for that.
Well, I mean, then whatever.
Yeah.
Corrupt.
Corruption
everywhere already.
So the Supreme Court would rule the transactions void, and Fall would be the first cabinet member to go to jail. Even though Harding was not implicated, his reputation would be tarnished. Another one of the scandals involved the Justice Department. Harding would appoint Harry Daughtry, who was one of his close allies from Ohio, as Attorney General. The move was panned because most felt he was not qualified for the job. So he is the head lawyer of the United States government, and most people feel he's not qualified for that.
I mean, I feel like that's a pretty important role in the United States justice system.
Yes.
And I feel like if, based off of what we've heard about his friends, Warren G. Harding's friends, none of them are qualified for this position. Not a single person.
I think that is an accurate statement. Daughtry would begin to be investigated for having a role in the Teapot Dome scandal. During the investigation, witnesses testified he was involved in other scandals as well.
Scandals.
You had Democratic Montana Senator Burton K. Wheeler was one of the investigating committee and assumed the role of prosecutor when hearings began on March 12, 1924. Jeff Smith, who had been a member of the Ohio Gang, had again engaged in influence peddling before his suicide. What you're going to see is there is a trend where people that are involved in these scandals all kill themselves. Or were they assassinated because they knew too much?
It's,
yes. All right. So was accused of conspiring with two other Ohioans, Howard Mannington and Fred Caskey, to accept payoffs from alcohol bootleggers to secure either immunity from prosecution or the release of liquor from government warehouses. So basically, Jeff Smith is in good with Daughtry. Jeff Smith is taking bribes from bootleggers who had been arrested, and basically Daughtry would give them like immunity so they wouldn't have to go to jail, and then re-release their alcohol so they could sell it, and basically Daughtry would get a kickback on it.
Wait, what year is this?
1924.
Oh, so yeah, Prohibition. Yeah. Okay.
So Mannington and Caskey's residence became infamous as the Little Greenhouse on K Street. Some witnesses, such as Smith's divorced wife, Roxy Stinson, and Krupp former FBI agent Gaston Means, alleged that Daughtry was personally involved. The illicit activity that caused Daughtry the most problems with was a Smith deal with Colonel Thomas W. Miller, a former Delaware congressman whom Harding had appointed alien property custodian. So what the alien property custodian did, it was like a position from like World War I to World War II. They basically, if there was like a German-owned company in the United States, they seized it and took control of it.
Okay.
Because Germany was considered an enemy at that point.
Right.
All right. So Smith and Miller received a payoff of almost $500,000 for getting a German-owned firm, the American Metal Company, released to new U.S. owners. Smith deposited $50,000 in a joint account with Daughtry, used for political purposes. Records relating to that account were destroyed by Daughtry and his brother. Miller and Daughtry were both indicted for defrauding the government. Daughtry would never be convicted and claimed his innocence. His reputation, however, would be ruined, and he would never be in political office again. He would blame his troubles on his enemies in the labor movement and on those dang communists. They were trying to take him down.
When in doubt,
blame the commies.
There you go. Yes.
Last political scandal that was linked to Harding involved the Veterans Bureau. Charles Forbes was director of the Veterans Bureau. He would look to consolidate the control of veterans hospitals and their construction in his new bureau.
Don't mess with the Veterans Bureau. There's no need.
Well, he does.
Leave it alone.
In 1922, Harding would agree to do so. Oh. Forbes' main job was to ensure that hospitals were being built around the country to serve 300,000 wounded veterans from World War I. Forbes would become friends with the owners of two major construction companies who began whining and dining him because they wanted the federal contracts to build the hospitals. Harding wanted all contracts to be open to the public, but Forbes worked out a deal where two companies would get the contracts and profits would be divided three ways.
He gets a little bit of the cut.
Yes. Forbes would then begin to defraud the government, increasing construction costs from $3,000 a bed to $4,000 a bed. So he could get a higher cut. So a tenth of the inflated construction billings were set aside for the conspirators, with Forbes receiving a third of that take. Forbes would then purchase a $20,000 tract of land in San Francisco for $105,000, pocketing $25,000 of the excess himself. So pretty much what he did is he went to the realtor. Realtor's like, $20,000 for this plot of land. He's like, I'll give you $105,000 of the government's money. You just got to give me $25,000 of that. He's an outstanding human being.
Harding might not be a smart man, but all his friends are, you know.
They're sneaky.
I mean, you got to be smart to pull these things off. Yeah. You just can't pull this off if you're, you know. This takes planning. So
Forbes was still intent on making more money and began selling valuable hospital supplies. This is when he gets in trouble because one of Harding's would eventually find out about Forbes' dealings and was enraged. Basically, like, Forbes, Harding's personal doctor was in, like, the supply chain of where Forbes was stealing all this medical equipment from. And he's like, hey, Warren, your guy's stealing all our stuff, and he's selling it. All right. So he summoned Forbes to the White House and demanded his resignation. Harding did not want an open scandal and allowed Forbes to flee to Europe from where he would resign. In spite of Harding's efforts, gossip about Forbes' activities resulted in the Senate ordering an investigation 2 weeks later. Forbes would eventually be convicted and spend 2 years in jail. Like I said, though, most of these scandals aren't going to hurt Harding politically because they all become public knowledge after he dies. Okay, as many political scandals as he also had a lot of personal scandals.
That's not...
Because his main concern in life was not politics.
It was obviously not the moral path that a president should have.
So Harding would also have his fair share of personal scandals. He was known to be quite the womanizer and had several extramarital affairs. Harding would have a 15-year affair with his friend's wife, Carrie Phillips, and Carrie Phillips was also his wife's best friend. The affair began when his wife was away getting medical treatment for a kidney ailment she had. Carrie Phillips and her husband, they had a son who died, and basically the husband, like, just went super, got super depressed about it. So he urged the husband to go to a mental asylum so he could get treatment for his depression. At that point, he starts an affair with Carrie Phillips.
Oh my goodness. He's done it.
Yes.
I mean, he's thought of everything.
He also has an affair with Nan Britton, who is 31 years younger than him. This was during his presidency. She was considered to be a groupie of Harding and had a deep obsession with him early on in life, so like since she was like 14. Like, I guess if you like went in their like bedroom in her like house, there was just like newspaper clippings, almost stalker-esque.
Kind of weird.
Yes.
Also, imagine if presidents still had groupies today, like a rock band does.
Yeah,
they had the groupies like that.
It's weird.
I mean, presidents.
So the affair would begin in a New York hotel room and would continue into multiple White House rooms and Senate chambers. The Secret Service actually had a plan put in place, so whenever Harding's wife Florence would enter the White House when he was with Nan, they would have like a code that he can hear, so like to get her out of the White House.
What's funny is that the Secret Service goes along with all this stuff.
Yes.
Like no one, like, I mean, their job is to serve the president. So basically, if the president does what he wants to do, they just kind of have to stand there and protect him. But you know, those are some pretty loyal guys.
So he's going to end up paying both women to keep silent about the affairs. And one of his things that he does a lot is when he's having these affairs, he keeps on telling the women who he's having the affairs with, "I'm leaving my wife. I'm leaving my wife so I can marry you." And then he never marries them.
But they get paid.
And well, some of them do.
Wow.
Carrie Phillips got paid $5,000 a month, which is a lot of money by today's standards and a lot of money for 1924 standards.
Yeah, eventually got to start thinking.
Keep quiet on top of an initial gift of $20,000. She and her husband would also be sent on a year-long trip around the world, so they would not be in the United States during his campaign.
Isn't that nice?
Nan Britton would get a lot less, but she would give birth to Harding's daughter. Harding would send her $500 a month via the Secret Service. So the Secret Service literally goes to her house, knocks on the door, and here's like $500 in an envelope.
I mean, I just imagine two guys in like all black suits and sunglasses just handing a briefcase over to this 14-year-old girl.
Oh, she's not 14 at this point.
Oh, this girl.
Yes.
Yeah.
She'd also get extra cash every time she would meet up with Harding. But when Harding died, those payments would stop and Nan would go public. And basically, Harding's family denied all these allegations, but in 2015 a DNA test was done and it proved that the girl was Harding's. Harding also wrote like a bunch of like love letters and things like that to Carrie Phillips, and like she's like, "You should probably have these," and he's like, "No, I want you to have them." Like, this is even after they split. And so then like when he dies, she tries to go and like publish them because they're very, very, let's just say I couldn't read them in a school setting.
Ah.
Yes.
Gotcha.
And like Harding's family like tries suing her, and then the federal government steps in and seizes them, and they're now in the Library of Congress.
They're in the Library of Congress.
Nice. So the Phillips and Britton affairs are well documented and not easily discounted, but there are other allegations that he had multiple other affairs. He was thought to have an affair with Gracie Cross, his staff secretary. In one account, a young Warren Harding had an affair with Susie Hodder, Florence Harding's best friend since childhood. Hodder gave birth to Harding's daughter, Marion Louise. He reportedly had a son with Rosa Cecilia Hoyle, a maid from California. Harding's affair with a woman named Augusta Cole resulted in an abortion, as well as Mrs. Cole's confinement to a sanitarium.
That's rough.
He also enjoyed the company of chorus girls, which is disturbing. Although not all their identities are known, some chorus girls such as Maisie Haywood and Blossom Jones can be identified as Miss Alicut, but by others are lost to history. And then a New York woman reportedly committed suicide after Harding bought her a house as a consolation prize when he seduced her but refused to marry her.
Well, here's the, I mean, okay.
He's a sleazeball.
The thing is, like, when you start paying people off or start buying houses, people start wondering where you're getting this money from.
Well, I know where he's getting money from.
No, not him. I know where he's getting the money from. Yes. I meant the people who I meant the women that are with him.
Oh.
Eventually, you know, people are going to ask questions. You know, and at least I would if, you know, you're in New York and you just get a brand new
house. Almost say his personal scandals are more horrible than his political scandals, because he's
okay. But in his political scandals, all yes, he covered them up, but like it wasn't like he was like
the mastermind behind him,
right?
Because he was too busy doing this stuff.
That's true.
I think this is his main concern.
It's
like a Hollywood movie. It's like that.
It feels like a Hollywood movie.
It's like a president that all he's concerned is with women, and meanwhile he's got all these cronies that are in the cabinet running the government and just stealing all the money.
I guess though, when you are a crony president, you know, you're not going to be as concerned with scandals as one might think. So there's that.
So Harding went to bed early in the evening of July 27, 1923, a few hours after giving a speech at the University of Washington. Later that night, he called for his doctor, complaining of pain in his stomach. His doctor thought that this was a reoccurring stomach upset, but others suspected it was a heart problem. The press was told Harding had experienced an acute gastrointestinal attack, and his scheduled weekend in Portland was canceled. He felt better the next day, and he would go to San Francisco. When they arrived in the morning, he insisted on walking from the train to the car, and was rushed to the Palace Hotel, where he suffered a relapse. If you want to go see the train that he traveled on, it's in the Southeast Train Museum in North Atlanta. It looks like the Polar Express train car.
Oh, really? That's cool.
Doctors found not only his heart was causing problems, but also that he had pneumonia, and he was confined to bed for the rest to rest in a hotel room. Doctors treated him with liquid caffeine and digitalis, which I'm not sure what that is.
So coffee and
something.
Okay.
And he seemed to improve. By the afternoon, though, Harding's condition still seemed to be improving, and his doctors allowed him to sit up in bed. At around 7:30, though, his wife, Florence, was reading him a calm review of A Calm Man, a flattering article about him. She paused and told him, "That's good. Go on, read some more." Or he told her that. Those would be his last words. She resumed reading. A few seconds later, Harding twisted convulsively and collapsed back in his bed, gasping. Florence Harding immediately called the doctors to his room, but they were unable to revive him with stimulants. He was pronounced dead a few minutes later at the age of 57. Harding's death was initially attributed to a cerebral hemorrhage, as doctors at the time did not generally understand the symptoms of cardiac arrest. Florence Harding, though, would not consent to have an autopsy done. So many believe that she may have poisoned him because she had become knowledgeable of all his extramarital affairs.
That's suspicious.
There is some suspicion of foul play there, yes. Also, you got to put into account all those people within his cab, all those people that were linked to his...
there's a whole lot of people who could kill him. I mean,
he's
got so many people.
All these people that are committing suicide that are linked to the scandals. There's kind of a weird...
Kind of an awkward, like, situation.
So Harding's unexpected death came as a great shock to the nation. He was liked and admired both by the press and the public.
Because I didn't know who he was.
Yes. This was because none of his scandals had become known to the public yet. Harding's body was carried by train in a casket for a journey across the nation. Over 9 million people would line up along the railroad tracks to see the train that was carrying his body. He's going to be buried in Marion. His body is going to be placed on a horse-drawn hearse, which was followed by President Coolidge and Justice Taft, and then by Harding's widow, Florence, and his father, Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, and Harvey Firestone would all go to his funeral. Imagine that. Big business coming to his funeral.
Oh, wow. Imagine.
After his death, though, his papers and documents regarding his presidency would begin to be released, and they showed just how corrupt his administration had been.
That is not.
And since then, he has become known as one of the most corrupt politicians ever.
That is not.
That is Warren G. Harding, folks.
It's rough.
Yeah. Don't know what to say about him.
Not much.
Like I said, I think his... his political scandals are bad, but like you said, he was never directly involved with it. He just covered them up. I think his extramarital scandals are just horrible, and he's a horrible human being.
Yep.
There we go.
Also, that plant are called foxgloves.
The what?
The digitalis are foxgloves.
What's that?
It's a type of plant.
Oh. So. Apparently, it didn't work.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for tuning in to History Class After Hours, the show where we talk about the things your history teachers didn't have time to teach you. If you wanted to stay updated on upcoming events for the History Club, please visit www.starsmillhistoryc.wixsite.com/2020. If you liked this episode, please share it with your friends and subscribe to our channel on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. Be on the lookout for new episodes, and we'll be posting every week. Until next time, stay curious.